The only thing funner than sharing names is sharing files. Okay, so I think we'll make this our last and shortest session, even though there's many more things that we could say, particularly in the light of the rather lively exchange of the last session. It just occurred to me that a prefix which came up a few times, but maybe not quite enough, was the prefix mis. Pryas brought up the notion of misuse and misuser, I think the day before yesterday, in talking about understanding. There's a particularly insidious form of not understanding, which is misunderstanding, because, of course, unlike non-understanding, misunderstanding believes itself to be an understanding, but is framed differently than what it's interfacing with, to use another term. And because we were talking about translation, I mean, something that I find particularly interesting, much more interesting than translation, actually, is mistranslation. Translation is usually thought to be an entropic process by which things are lost in translation. Of course, many things are gained as well. And it makes me almost think, not trying to avoid the trap of saying that all translations are mistranslations, which would mean that it's not very interesting to pursue that line. But one thing that might allow us to think that all translations are mistranslations is the coefficient of presence of the translator within the translation. This is going to the last thing which I'll just throw out into our discursive commons is that let me put it this way that Canadian songwriter Leonard Cohen regularly sings that there's a crack in everything, that's how the light gets in. There's a crack in everything, that's how the light gets in. And in a sense, there's some mystical overtones in that, but the idea is that it's only because there is a mistake, a fault, a fissure, an anomaly, something wrong, that there is enlightenment at all. And you think, well, what does that have to do with translation? Well, for many years I was a translator in a different life, and it's a kind of a thankless job in a way. Although it's conceptually absolutely exciting, but it's a bit of drudgery. Why is it drudgery? Not because you have to sit on your ass and just work away hour after hour, but because there's a certain understanding of success in translation which biases us to think that the more the subjectivity of the translator disappears from the translation, the better the translation job. So the better you do your work, the more you don't exist anymore. This process of subjective self-effacement can be pretty hard on the ego. And it's like when in the passage on use value in Capital, where Marx talks about how dead labor disappears into the commodity and in fact can only reemerge when we're reminded that every object is invested with human labor. And when does that happen? It happens, Marx says, when the string breaks, when the scissors fail to cut. In other words, when there's something wrong, when there's an anomaly, when there's a crack, then the light can get in, and we remember, in fact, and on a larger scale, of course, we could say it's when the company, the railway workers go on strike, that we're reminded that railways don't just run on their own, but in fact they are staffed by countless laborers. And so it's that sort of that translator's paradox by which sometimes the translator injects a little bit of something to, so that rather than the text appears to have emerged in its new language, there are certain traces that it actually was translated there. And that's not necessarily a worse translation. Only in a certain conception of translation is that actually to be devalorized. In fact, one might say that it's important, or that the aesthetics of translation, or even the ethics of translation, is based on every translator's decision to what extent his or her subjectivity should be present in that translation, to what extent there should be a trace of estrangement or distancing that allows that translation to appear as a translation even while being eminently readable. That occurred to me in our discussions about, well, on the river, you know, about this, how this river started out with one name up in Tibet, it now has another one and will soon have another as it gets to Bangladesh, and yet it's the same. Somehow this naming process is also a means of recalling the, I don't know, the collective subjectivity, something like that, of those who live along its shore. So I just thought I would, since we were talking about translation, and I don't only mean linguistic translation, that was my personal initiation to that idea, but all forms of translating, I don't know, identities into different political ontologies to give them, so that they cease to appear as minorities or tribals or as migrants or as workers and can be translated into a political ontology where they are able to transcend that. But it's, in a sense, it's only, that can never be a smooth shift because, once again, it's only in that wedging open that breach of strangeness that the light is able to find its way in.
No, I was just endorsing your gesture.
Oh.
I was agreeing with you.
Well, perhaps someone would like to.
Linguistic translation, but of a very strange kind. In Gujarat, there is this writer called Ashwini Bhatt, who's basically in the last 20 years made his career out of translating John Grisham novels into Gujarati. So, John Grisham novels into Gujarati. So he basically takes up a John Grisham novel, keeps the English name, so the Pelican Brief remains the Pelican Brief. Is that John Grisham? It is, right? Yeah. Anyway, so the title remains the same, but it's in Gujarati, and then it's translated by him. In 20 years, he ran out of John Grisham novels to translate. But it was a full-fledged career, and there's a huge readership for it. So he started producing novels or translations of novels which do not exist. So he fabricated English titles, and he kept them on his Gujarati novels, and he wrote, so it basically says XYZ by John Grisham, translated by Ashwini Bhatt, but it's an original novel, which now circulates in the translation of certain
Shadow.
Songs. So I thought it was an interesting anecdote to float for you. It was, for me, I was completely obsessed by the whole idea of writing a translation where the original does not exist, because within the original / translated copy now, he has to make similar choices about effacement and where his subjective interpretations or writings will cease so that it still looks like it is translated with certain kinds of names, certain kinds of places, certain phrases which are retained in English, and so on. So I thought it was just another kind of translation that we always presume there is an original and a copy, but it doesn't always have to be so. That there are sometimes translations which do not have originals.
Translation ex nihilo.
Yeah, something like that. And it would, for me, it would be so interesting if somebody actually now manages to translate Ashwini Bhatt's novel into English and saying, here is the original John Grisham novel, which is based on Ashwini Bhatt's translation.
He dreams of the day when he gets that email.
Yes, he does.
What's his name?
Ashwini Bhatt.
The interesting thing is how the new James Bond novels were written by other writers. No. I mean, just jokingly telling Monica just now, that just proves that the aura is more important than the novel itself, and you can reproduce the aura of John Grisham and endlessly produce John Grisham novels. Fascinating.
Or the fact that it's not really the linguistic translation which is at play, because it's a paradigm translation. It's a genre which is being translated for a certain kind of economic production, and because it has a readership, it will continue. So that Ashwini Bhatt, who's now also basically 84, doesn't necessarily write all the original translated John Grisham novels. He also has ghostwriters who write under his name these new translation novels.
Outsourced.
Yeah. So it's a fascinating industry because it's a very subversion of the translation model, so to speak, in many ways.
Story going to come out, it's also going to have a new character. So you have, I think when the corporation, and I think this is interesting because the notion of the individual in which there's the idea of the individual who's doing the, you know, in this case it is the idea of the individual. And the fact that the corporation calls itself an individual in law and creates its own loopholes is a different discussion. But the fact is that when a corporation can take on this role, then it becomes a different kind of playing field. And it, and then you, it, then it is no longer considered a kind of. I think it's. I'm just thinking this aloud. What is it that transforms when you no longer have to play this by the? It could also have been the Ashwini Bhatt, I don't know, AB company, ABC producing John Grisham, and then I kind of the same issues would hold. Would we still think of it as a kind of new trans? You know what I mean? Like if I'm making new Winnie the Pooh stories, as part of the corporate structure, or if I'm making it individually. Is there a difference in the idea of creativity itself, or is it just a kind of economic paradigm only? And I'm wondering here also when you say that it's an economic paradigm that makes him do these kind of things. But one could say that, but one could also say that maybe there's been no history of genre writing of a certain kind in a certain language, which is why you need a crutch to do this. You could say that, there are lots of reasons why this thing, and economics is one of it.
The Gujarati history of translating things which are popular is amazing, because in the 1920s, there was this writer who was sitting in Ahmedabad and Chunilal Vardhaman Shah, and he was like a strange character. He would translate these serial films used to come to cinema halls at that point in time. So, Pearl White and, you know, like Fantomas and films like that. And he would actually translate these movies, the action. So, it was interesting because it's somewhere a surplus for the film, because in the film, you would only have intertitles. What he would do is actually describe the action of the film and produce a novelization and things like that, and that's a books out of those serial films, like it, you know.
And I also think there is also another strange.
That is of course.
Yeah,
I mean,
but that's not dubbing. What the clip I've seen is the guy narrating on top of it. There is the original audio is completely muted, so there is just one narrator's voice. A marichi, odish, 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 and like, so along with the sound effects, and like he's just kind of narrating the whole visual.
That's like a Laura Mulvey of Bengal.
It's like that early that Japanese thing, right? Where there's a narrator in front of the screen.
Benchi.
Yeah. Yes, Kimarchis, whatever, like, you know, it's like he's just, like, now he'll come, now look, he's coming from that side, and he's going to encounter this, and he's just like, kind of like the sutradhar of the, yeah, so it wasn't dubbed, it was just one guy, like, who's just talking on top of the visual roots, which the sound of the origin film is completely muted. Bangladesh, not West Bengal.
But within Gujarati, there is also then another register of translation which I find extremely fascinating. Is this within a Gujarati text, and there are these English sentences which just exist, even if it's a translation of the English novel.
Oh, I have a very interesting example like that.
And
like
it goes all the way to Saraswati Chandra, right? Like when the fourth volume of Saraswati Chandra gets written, and Saraswati Chandra is now telling Kumudasundari, but actually telling the rest of the nation and how the nation has to be built. He has entire sentences which are in English in the most classical Gujarati text ever. And that kind of a tradition of writing continues in translation as well, which is very peculiar, saying that I will not translate. I will keep that entire phrase or sometimes paragraphs in that original language for you to read, because I'm presuming that if you're reading a translated copy, you also, like the translator, have dual language capacities. That you have some capacity of understanding the original language as well as the translated word.
But the English is written in Roman, or it's written in
Roman.
In Roman.
Yeah.
I have books like these are electronic manuals, electronic kit manuals, which are available at Lajpat Rai Market.
So it's manuals to how to repair mobile phones and television sets. So they're just the components and parts and processes are all written in English, but the grammar is constructed. It is completely enmeshed. It's not just one sentence, but the whole book is like that, with like Roman and Devanagari just like mixing together like fluidly, like, you know. So yeah.
Indian writing in English, which is by now no longer considered IWE, but is just novel writing. This has been a bigger question. The politics of how one writes, how one narrates a world which your language is English, your first language is English, say, or your main language is English, but there's a lot of the phatic, or there's a kind of texture of life which you do not address or comes to you in English. So whether it's Salman Rushdie, one of the earliest people who uses, he does it in a kind of way that he takes and then twists and then twists again, like bastard. I remember that, and the kind of the play of meaning that happens across languages. But there are lots of other novelists who look at this as not as a kind of a translation, because translation is not only a question of comprehension, it's also the politics of locality and location and language and how. My book is in English and it's primary, but who is the, so then the question of who is it being written for becomes like a big debate in, if I'm writing in English, and most, it's often going to be read abroad in the English speaking world, but I expect them to figure out for themselves without a glossary. There used to be a sort of generation of writers who put a glossary at the back, and they said, why should we have a glossary? And this is perhaps why the whole question of languages emancipating themselves from their own dictionaries to make new dictionaries also comes back into play.
Religious and sacred patterns in white flower powder outside door. Like there's this Rangoli, which is quite a significant part of Indian culture and different customs. It's patterns, literally it's religious and sacred patterns made out of rice, white rice flour on the doorsteps of Brahmin. They think there's an entire definition of Rangoli which he produces.
One of the most interesting contemporary Assamese scholars is somebody who actually works in Persian. Assamese people are lucky because they don't have this kind of self-reflexive obsession that their other neighbors have. So his name is Sanjeev Phukan, and he's a librarian right now at the Rampur Nawab's Library, which is one of the greatest collection of Persian manuscripts in South Asia. And he's written extensively on this business of moving between Persian and Urdu, which is a sort of cognate language but different, and talks about it in terms of the relationship between rivers, which is interesting because it's like if you have two rivers flowing through a landscape, then there are times when the rivers change course and become each other and then diverge, which is what he treats the whole relationship between Urdu and Persian as being. And one of the things he talks about is that in the course of meeting and diverging, what gets formed are sandbanks and islands. So linguistic sandbanks and islands between the registers of speech in Persian and Urdu, and which is for me always a very evocative concept because it is surrounded by a linguistic universe which is neither this nor that, but partakes equally of both. Which is why, for instance, in Urdu there is almost always a convention of certain people, certain poets writing the third or the fourth lines of their verses entirely in Persian, so which means that the vocabulary is the same, that you use the same words as you would in Urdu, but change the grammatical structure. Particularly, for instance, gender, because Urdu has gender, but Persian has none. And the same sentence then repeated in Persian completely complicates the gender of the reader and the listener.
A very interesting thing that comes through in cosmopolitanism, or this kind of languages being spoken side by side. I mean, I've been working on the bazaar now for some time and kind of interested in what happens in a bazaar in terms of transactions. And bazaar is, of course, the place where all the languages are produced at some point in the subcontinent. But then there's something interesting that, you know, when you're reading the chronicles across 300 years, by the time you reach the 18th or 19th century, then there's this very interesting trope that is being introduced in the biographies of poets and things like that, which interestingly is taken up by Mehboob Khan in his films repeatedly. It's the logic of childhood in a cosmopolitan space, you know, where then a certain kind of mingling of languages can happen. And it's a very, very important trope that starts to run from the 18th, 19th century texts about childhoods and relating to the processes that you're talking about, that this intermingling and this becomes a kind of complex and interestingly kind of standardized as well as codified processes precisely when there's a certain moment in the history of populations and things like that where lots of people start spending their childhoods in this kind of a very cosmopolitan space, which then has a completely different relationship with the history of these languages. That there's this moment in a shift between or the intersection between history and demography, which is interesting. I mean, which is a lot of that is in Ghatak's films as well. The childhood is disrupted within a cosmopolitan space, and then how do you then go to another land which nominally belongs to your language, but you actually miss the fact that plurality is gone. I mean, West Bengal can never be East Bengal because that plurality that you have grown up in is precisely what is missing. West Bengal is an alien land. And so even if you are Bengali, nominally, it's a plurality of the organic sensorium and whatever makes you in terms of nature as well as languages as well as practices. If that is disrupted, then all hell breaks loose, even if nominally you are a Bengali. I mean, that's interesting.
Okay, it's just past one, so it's probably time to wrap up our conversation provisionally, have some food, hang out a bit, huh? Well, not have some food. Is there some last word someone would like to add?
No, it's not by way of a last word, but just as a token of gratitude and acknowledgement. when we came here, I don't quite know, I seriously didn't know what we were letting ourselves in for. But I think the last days have been really enjoyable because of the fact that the course of the conversation has changed but stayed the same, like a river. So it's still the same conversation that began 3 days ago, but we can now name it differently depending on the different days. And it's a lost art, almost, this ability to hold together the banks of the conversation over an extended period of time. So I just personally like to thank Mrigank and Sonal and Rene and Stephen for holding the banks of the conversation in through their utterances and through their silences. I think it's a fantastic job that you've done as hosts and guests. Thank you.
I would just like to say again, thank you for everyone for coming and our hosts. And I'm sorry that I have not yet been able to upload things to the blog, but I will do that as soon as possible and send out mails when I can. Doing it.
When do you want to come, Vishal?
No, the best season we already found out is May and June. Best weather.
Yeah. Send him during the heat.
You don't have to buy anything.
Yeah.
The dog grows in the wild.
No, but I'd just like to say thank you to everyone for coming. And I'm sure we'll have you know, I'm really sure we'll have a lot more sessions like this in the future. Yeah, of course. So, and I just hope that this is the beginning to a lot more sessions on the ferry, and with the ferry, of course, moving for the second and third time.
I think I begin with a quote by Martha Rosler, and I think we didn't had any problem having this conversation for the last 2 days, and I think to extend this whole idea of what yesterday people are talking about, manifesto, latento, and charter, and vision, and aims, I think this has been one of the most important idea which we wanted to do with the space, because I think workshops, residencies, they were just to cover up our, you know, what we really want to do as an artist, because we wanted space. You know, I was telling somebody, like a filmmaker, you end up making a film, the kind of film which you want to see. It's out of your dissatisfaction, you know. So there is never a perfect film or the perfect things. So when a space, I think I'll tell in my very plain words that, you know, when you're not happy with the space or your place, and then you end up creating one. And I think the problem of any kind of space is that, okay, it's only by making which, is it, can it happen? Like when Martha Rosler said a room, how can you create a room? You know, like, you know, what is a room? So working on that idea, I think it had been incredibly, we are grateful to all of you too, because with all your different fluxes and all the different, things which you have contributed to this rivers, and I think all of you also literally also corresponds to one river, or I don't know, something very fictional and imaginary. So and I hope this will continue, because it's like ports, it's very sad, it's very sad and as interesting that how ports become like redundant space, and then how it reminds you of those trade routes, those transactions, and different. And we are also, we'd like you to also, we are not that good at networking in the sense of create our web space as a possible thing, which we can contribute to news and other kinds of things. Like this another collaboration which we are already engaged in with this London-based organization, we're talking about Thames and Brahmaputra, and through that, it's not about only Thames and Brahmaputra, but the whole idea of what really happened during colonialism in terms of, you know, trades and politics and other kinds of things. How can we negotiate that? That reminds me of a very interesting thing, which we presented this in London about this project. I said, you know, I think we are not doing something completely new. It has happened. Like there was this merchant called, I don't know his first name. I just read his read his accounts. His name was Renel, and he happens to be a merchant who deals with spice and other things from India. And he's a simple, you know, like what Sonal said. I think Bania or something. But he ended up making a space where he used to create a conversation with people in his, you know, boats. And he used to talk with these different kinds of people, including not getting into the politics, definitely, but he created that space. So I said, I think we're not doing something, we're trying, in London only. I couldn't locate, it's about 200 years old, but that from his accounts that he talks about Brahmaputra in the banks of Thames and saying that, you know, that's what really happened and kind of things. And so I think that we are creating a lineage of, you know, this series of conversations and things. And I think it can also, because rivers are networks, I think. Rivers are the best possible things of network, which we didn't say it explicitly. It also connects, you know, to all the differences and other kinds of things which don't need any medium to contribute. Like river can be really flood, river can be completely drought. But now kind of things, it's completely also very geophysical that, you know, floating on this river, there are many other concerns which really also reminds us, like China trying to build a couple of dams and changing the course of this river. So it's not that we are completely creating a reclusive space which we are not really aware of. So this, even this physicality, not only gives you the sense of, you know, containment, but it reminds you of many other things which we need to bring inside these things. So that's it, I think.
Is that a wrap? It's a wrap. Thank you, everyone.